It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Egypt strikes back following the mass beheadings of Coptic Christians. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Egypt carried out a second round of airstrikes in eastern Libya Monday in swift retaliation for the massacre of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians by Islamic State militants in Libya. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi had pledged an immediate response, calling the killings an abhorrent act of terror. Nasser Kamal is Egypt's ambassador to the United Kingdom.
We're saddened, shocked, but we believe that this is part of a whole phenomena we've been facing in Egypt and throughout the Arab world in the last few years. We need to pull our force together and face this threat.
The Libyan Air Force joined the strikes, which targeted militant weapons caches and training camps. Thousands of Liberian children returned to school on Monday after a six-month school closure during the height of the Ebola epidemic. Students washed their hands and had their temperatures taken before entering classes. School principal Rosemarie Gray says it's important students not miss more school than they have to, even if Ebola is not completely eradicated.
If we wait for a day that Ebola be eradicated before we reopen schools, I don't think we are ever going to open schools, because even now, I've also heard that there's a new outbreak. Nobody knows how far it's going to go. If schools continue to close perpetually, our students will be being at home.
Not all Liberian schools open Monday. Some remain closed. A Liberian education official said all schools must be open by March 2nd. Some students have been following their classes using radio during the epidemic. This is VOA News. The United States says it's gravely concerned over the deteriorating situation in and around the eastern Ukrainian town of Debaltseve, where pro-Russian rebels are refusing to honor an internationally brokered ceasefire. Washington noted nearly 130 ceasefire violations have been recorded since late Sunday, along with five fatalities. A ceasefire agreement was announced last week by Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France, which calls for government and separatist forces to withdraw heavy weapons. But a rebel commander said Sunday separatist fighters would not observe the truce. Alexander Hug is deputy chief of a monitoring mission of the organization for security and cooperation in Europe.
We have reported that the areas where the ceasefire at the moment is not holding fully or comprehensively is in Donetsk City, in Debaltseve, as well as in and around Luhansk.
The German, French, and Ukrainian leaders voiced concern about the ongoing fighting in Debaltseve. They called for European security monitors to be given access to the city, which the rebels have so far blocked. Danish media are reporting the gunman who attacked a free speech seminar in a synagogue in Copenhagen was a former convict who had recently been radicalized, perhaps while in prison. Police haven't released the shooter's name, but the media have identified him as Omar Abdel Hamid El Hussein, who had been incarcerated for stabbing a passenger on a train. Separate Saturday attacks at a cafe and synagogue killed two, wounded five. Tens of thousands of Danes gathered for vigils across the country. Matthias was one of some 30,000 who gathered in Copenhagen to honor the victims.
I think it's important for all of us to show up and to express that we are united as a, not just as a city, but also as a country.
Danish officials Monday said there is no indication the gunman who carried out deadly attacks was part of a terrorist cell. Police say they've arrested two men on suspicion of helping the gunman. In Mali, seven UN peacekeepers were wounded Sunday in an explosion in Tabankort in the northeast, a scene of deadly violence among rival militia. The cause of the Sunday's blast remains unknown. Meanwhile, the Malian government and Tuareg-led rebels resumed UN-sponsored peace talks in Algeria. In 2012, northern Mali fell under control of the separatist Tuaregs, and then by an al-Qaeda-linked radical group, prompting a French military intervention. The White House is hosting a three-day summit beginning Tuesday on violent extremism. High-level officials from a dozen countries expected to be on hand. U.S. officials say the goal is to empower communities to push back against extremism. Organizers will highlight U.S. community programs that have been established in the cities of Boston, Los Angeles, and Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Libya vows to exterminate Islamic State fighters after Egyptian-Libyan airstrikes.
Libyan Air Force Commander Saker al-Jarushi says combined Libyan-Egyptian attacks Monday hit Islamic State-controlled areas near oil fields and training camps and sent some fighters fleeing the country by boat.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdock in Cairo. Some residents of northeast Nigeria are relocated to avoid possible election-related violence. The European Union provides $270 million assistance to Zimbabwe, marking the beginning of a cooperation after years of sanctions. And Central African leaders create a fund to fight Boko Haram.
The 10 members of the Economic Community of Central African States agreed Monday to contribute most of the $100 million needed to combat Boko Haram.
That's reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Yaoundé, Cameroon. And South Sudan's government threatens to shut down local media houses if they interview rebels and disseminate the information. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Libyan authorities have promised to continue attacking Islamic State targets after reportedly successful Egyptian-Libyan airstrikes early on Monday. Analysts say while the Egyptian bombing was a reaction to the slaughter of 21 Egyptian Christians, it could also signify what may be a larger change in Egypt's military policy. Heather Murdock has more for VOA from Cairo.
Libyan Air Force Commander Saker al-Jarushi says combined Libyan-Egyptian attacks Monday hit Islamic State-controlled areas near oil fields and training camps and sent some fighters fleeing the country by boat. Analysts say Libya's campaign against Islamic State has been largely unsuccessful, and the militant group has steadily gained ground in the past year. But they say Egyptian support could turn the tide. Kamal Abdullah is a Libya specialist at the Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Egypt. He says Egypt's army is one of the most powerful in the region, but Monday's attacks were a reaction to the gruesome video released over the weekend, not a change in policy. In the video, 21 Egyptian Christians appeared to be slaughtered on a beach by Islamic State militants. After the video was released, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to hit back, saying Egypt has the right to retaliate when and how it chooses. But Ziad A. Akel, a senior researcher also at Al Ahram Center, says the airstrikes could signal that Egypt's policy against Islamic State might be changing. In the past, he says, Egypt has supported the Libyan military mainly with training and capacity building.
I don't think that they will continue in that manner. I think that Egypt is about to rethink the pattern of its involvement within Libya. The real policy change, I think, is coming on the way.
The shift, he adds, is unlikely to mean Egyptian troops on the ground. However, he says Egypt has strong economic and security reasons to fight Islamic State.
The prioritization of the terrorism war would definitely overlap the economic dimension within this issue.
Analysts say millions of Egyptians work in Libya and many remain in the most dangerous parts of the country, even after Libyan authorities stopped issuing visas for Egyptians and Egyptian authorities told citizens in Libya to go home. Mr. Sisi has also been battling Islamists at home since he took power in 2013, some on political grounds, like the Muslim Brotherhood, others for their militancy, including jihadists in Sinai, allied with the Islamic State. Mr. Sisi's government conflates the two groups, and Akel says Egypt's current political climate is against any form of political Islam. However, supporting Libya's army against Islamic State also means choosing sides in Libya's larger conflict, says Abdullah.
في ليبيا ولا سوريا؟ هو طبعا خلينا نكون واقعيين في ليبيا مع الأسف.
He says Libya, with two rival governments claiming power, has never been more chaotic or dangerous. Egypt is working with the army that has the support of the internationally recognized parliament, a parliament that only supported the campaign against Islamic State after it was well underway. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Central African leaders have called for the creation of a special fund to help countries affected by Boko Haram. Meeting in Cameroon's capital on Monday, the leaders discussed details of the regional force being deployed to combat the Nigerian insurgent group, which has extended its attack to Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
The 10 members of the Economic Community of Central African States agreed Monday to contribute most of the $100 million needed to combat Boko Haram. They also called for quick UN approval of a multinational force to pave the way for military involvement by other African nations. ECAS chair and Chadian president Idris Deby did not say how much has been raised for the fund, but said some of the money will be used to improve living conditions for people displaced by the militants group.
Il est difficile pour nos États de faire face à ces menaces isolément. Nos États membres qui ne sont...
Mr. Deby says it is difficult for Central African states to face this scourge alone and calls for others not touched by terrorism to show solidarity with affected countries. He also calls for the international community to bring material, diplomatic, financial and logistical support to combat Boko Haram. ECAS Secretary General Ahmad Alami said the leaders are still seeking international help to eradicate the Islamist extremist group, which has killed thousands of people in the past 5 years and displaced about 1 million more.
Boko Haram ne lésine sur aucun moyen pour répandre sa barbarie. Ce groupe terroriste.
He says Boko Haram is using all barbaric means against the people, using asymmetric methods that make the battle complex and very expensive. He says there is need for solidarity and an appropriate response to eradicate the group that is out to destabilize the entire region. Burundi and the Central African Republic announced they will contribute troops to the joint task force. CAR Foreign Affairs and Integration Minister Toussaint Kongo Dudu says despite the crisis in his country, it will support Cameroon and Chad.
If Boko Haram goes to Cameroon, it will be a total disaster for Central African Republic. Fighting against Boko Haram means strengthening our capacity to resolve the political crisis and the security crisis back home.
Leaders from Angola, Burundi, Cameroon, Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, Central African Republic, and Sao Tome and Principe took part in Monday's meeting. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
In northeast Nigeria, the insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. But that is not the only threat to security. As viewers and Look reports, people are moving their families away from sites of possible tension around the country and are preparing for unrest once the election results are announced.
From the Niger Delta to the far northeast, the pre-election period has become a time of migration for some Nigerians. VOA met several on the streets of Kaduna.
My wife has been pestering me for the past 3 months. Even today she called to say, are we ready to move?
Nobody wants to die for nothing. So I myself, I'm even planning to relocate to certain part of Kaduna where I will not be hearing sound of war, drums of crisis, burning of tires and tear gas and all those kind of stuff. I don't want to see all those rubbish.
If before the elections they are already tearing posters, you know, burning cars, injuring people, and are already being violent before the election, that anything can happen either during or after the elections.
Nigeria's last nationwide vote in 2011 was praised as more credible than any before it. But more than 1,000 people were killed, most of them during post-election violence, and mostly in Kaduna State, where politics sparked sectarian and communal tensions. The 2015 elections are shaping up to be the most hotly contested in Nigeria's democratic history. President Goodluck Jonathan and the ruling PDP party are facing a strong challenge from the opposition APC and its candidate, former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. Voters are nervous about the post-election period.
We'll take our time, we'll go and vote, and we'll stay back and inside our houses, and we'll look on how the election and the outcome of it will be. But certainly we have to go and vote.
Nigeria's police chief issued a statement this month trying to reassure voters and calling for them to stop relocating. But the pre-election incidents have been piling up. Party headquarters have been bombed or vandalized. Opposition supporters say they have been attacked in Rivers State. A suicide bomber blew herself up in Gombe as President Goodluck Jonathan finished his rally there. Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission says at least 58 people have been killed in pre-election violence since December. Lagos, Kaduna, and Rivers State, it says, have had the most incidents. Nigeria's Electoral Commission postponed the polls by 6 weeks to March 28th after security forces said they needed more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast and ensure voting is safe. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 17. Let's give a shout out to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations: Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia; Brela FM in Nigeria; Kisi FM in Tanzania; Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi; Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda; Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya; and Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon; and our VOA frequency station in Abidjan, Ivory Coast; and Diamond FM in Tamale, Ghana. Still to come, Mark Oldman's Post and our Black History and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The European Union on Monday provided development assistance to Zimbabwe amounting to $270 million to mark the resumption of cooperation between Brussels and Harare following the imposition of restrictive measures on President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle over a decade ago. Thomas Chiripasi has details from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare.
The European Union and the government of Zimbabwe signed the National Indicative Programme, a joint cooperation strategy between Harare and Brussels that will be funded by the 11th European Development Fund between 2014 and 2020. Speaking at the signing ceremony in Harare Monday, EU Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Philippe Van Dam, said he hoped that the resources would be put to good use, adding that he expects Harare to institute some democratic reforms.
We agreed with the government and the National Authorizing Officer that we would try to commit more than half of the National Indicative Program this year, helping the government kickstarting its reform agenda, underpinning our common commitment to move forward to stop economic and social decline and to give hope to the people of this country.
To ensure that there was better cooperation between Harare and Brussels, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa says the EU should immediately lift sanctions on President Robert Mugabe and his wife Grace, imposed in 2002 for alleged election rigging and human rights violations.
This signing ceremony, Your Excellency, is a significant step towards normalization of our relations. While we have taken these significant steps towards normalization, we must remain cognizant of the fact that there is still unfinished business. Zimbabwe Incorporated, I'm talking here of Zimbabwe, the economy, has a chief executive. And as long as the chief executive remains under sanctions, our relations remain poisoned and unproductive. I therefore take this opportunity to call for the unconditional lifting of sanctions against our head of state, His Excellency, and the First Lady.
Political analyst Ernest Mudzengi, director of the Media Center, tells Studio 7 that the restrictive measures were not serving any purpose towards the revival of the country's economy.
This government of President Robert Mugabe continues to use those restrictions as an excuse for its failure to turn around the economy.
The EU says that under this agreement, €6 million were set aside for civil society, and the money will be channeled through government. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makui on Monday repeated a warning he made last year for media houses and journalists not to publish or broadcast interviews with rebels inside South Sudan. He warned that if they do, they could face harsh punishment. Michael Atit of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has this report.
Makwe's warning came after United Nations radio station Miraya FM aired a pre-recorded interview with one of the opposition officials who defected from the President Kiir administration when the crisis broke out in December 2013. Makwe's latest warning is the first of 2015. The information minister issued the stern caution at this morning media briefing about a cabinet resolution on delaying elections and extending the terms of President Kiir and the national lawmakers. Makwe says the government will follow through and punish anyone who ignores the warning.
We are shutting you down if you interview any rebel here to disseminate his or her plans and policies within South Sudan. I'm sorry, we will shut down that way. It has never happened in the world where you find views of the rebels being disseminated by media houses which are inside the country.
Makwe also repeated something said last year when he first made the warning, that journalists who go ahead and publish or broadcast interviews with armed opposition are agitators and rebels themselves and will suffer the consequences.
If you can go as far as interviewing the rebels to come and disseminate their filthy ideas to the people and poison their minds, that is a negative agitation. You will either join them or else we put you where you will not be talking.
Journalists and rights groups say that though there were some limits in free speech in South Sudan before the conflict, the crisis has made the situation worse. Several media houses have been closed, newspapers have had their entire prints run seized, and many journalists have been arrested or detained, including several this month. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Defending champions Ivory Coast fought hard from behind to hold underdogs South Africa to a 2-2 draw at the Orange African Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger on Monday. Ntutuko Mbata and Eric Mayo scored for South Africa before Kofi Kouao and Idrissa Doumbia replied for the defending champions. In the other group B tie, Mali beat Cameroon 3-1 in a thrilling encounter. Mamadou Sangare, Sekou Koita and Boubacar Traore found the back of the net for Mali, while captain Martin Hongla scored for Cameroon. Turning to athletics, Kenyan defending champion Florence Kiplagat retained her Barcelona half-marathon title in style in Spain on Sunday. Kiplagat clocked 1 hour, 5 minutes and 9 seconds, which is 3 seconds faster than the world record she set at this very race last year. In Italy, Ethiopian Mukhtar Edris emerged winner in the men's race at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in San Vittore Olona on Sunday. He was followed across the finish line by Kenyans Alex Kibet and Jairus Birech, then Burundi's Oliviera Itrabaruta, while Kenyan Viola Jelagat prevailed in the women's race. In Uganda, the world junior mountain running champion Philip Kipyeko edged defending champion Moses Kipsiro in the sprint for the finish line to win the senior men's 12 kilometers at the Uganda Cross-Country Championships in Jinja, some 80 kilometers east of the capital, Kampala, on Saturday. Meanwhile, back in action after a layoff through injury, Julia Chekwel is the surprise winner in the senior women's 8 kilometers, while the world junior 10,000-meter champion Joshua Cheptegei retained the junior men's 8-kilometer crown as world junior mountain running champion Stella Chesang won the junior girls' 6 kilometers. Uganda Athletics Federation used the event to choose their team for the IAAF World Cross Country Championships due in China next month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Put your bad self, say it louder. Say it louder.
time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 17th. On this day in 1942, Huey Newton was born. He co-founded the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. Newton called on blacks to arm themselves against white racism and oppression. Also on this day in 1902, singer Marian Anderson was born in Philadelphia. Her dream was to sing with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. But like every black person in those days, Marian was discriminated against because of the color of her skin. In 1939, Marian was to sing at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., but she was refused permission because she was black. Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of President Franklin Roosevelt, said Marian could sing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. On this day in 1963, Michael Jeffrey Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time, was born in New York City. Jordan was one of the most effectively marketed athletes of his generation and was instrumental in popularizing the NBA around the world in the 1980s and 1990s. He holds the NBA record for highest career regular season scoring average with 30.12 points per game, as well as averaging a record 33.4 points per game in the NBA playoffs. And on this day in 1891, African-American inventor A.C. Richardson invented the wooden churn, a device that made it easier to convert cream into butter and forever changed the food industry. He was a prolific visionary who invented numerous devices, including an insect destroyer. And on this day in African history in 1982, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, then Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, dismissed coalition partner Joshua Nkomo from the cabinet. This follows the discovery of arms caches on farms owned by Nkomo, who had been accused by Mugabe of plotting a coup. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 17th. Congratulations to Titus Kwekwe of Kuran Lutheran Hospital in Zorza, Lofa County, Liberia, Jones Ronnie Dejo of Accra, Ghana, and Abraham Lang of National Root Crops Research Institute in Jos, Plateau State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 16th question. What prestigious award did Dr. Charles Richard Drew receive in 1944? The answer, the Spingarn Award. Now here is our question for today, February 17th. During what basketball game did Wilt Chamberlain become the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points? Once again, during what basketball game did Wilt Chamberlain become the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
As I take two eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share. Say it loud. Say it loud. One more time. Say it loud. I worked on jobs with my feet in my hands. You know, all the work I did was for the other
and,
man.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Egypt carried out a second round of airstrikes in eastern Libya on Monday in swift retaliation for the massacre of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians by Islamic State militants in Libya. That is it for this Tuesday, February 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Marco Woman, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Butte wishing all of you in Africa a good day.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.